Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Cholley. A little bit croaky after a night out last night. It's exciting, isn't it? Now parties are back before you all get pinged again. Coming up, we've got the amazing Harry Enfield talking about his new stage show at the Windsor's Endgame, but also Tory Boy, Loads of Money, and the amazing BBC sketch, the Question Time sketch. If you haven't watched it before, you're allowed to pause the podcast and go off and watch that, and then you can come back and listen to Harry Enfield. In a moment, we'll also hear from our columnist panel, Night at the Marriott. But a reminder, if you want to come and do the quiz, particularly if you're listening from outside the UK, international quizzes are needed for our Thursday quiz. So if you want to play our quiz, can you get to number 10? Just email me now with your details, matt.jolly@times.radio, and we'll get you on the radio very soon. Right, Harry Enfield is coming up, but first it's Thursday, so our columnist panel is Night at the Marriott. It's India Knight and James Marriott. So let's start with books today, because obviously MPs are packing up and heading off on their summer holidays while also working very hard on their constituencies, of course. And the Publishers Association, that's 125 years old this year, and they have asked MPs, peers, journalists, for their summer reading recommendations. And James, you've been casting an eye over the list. What are MPs going to be reading on their sun loungers?
It's interesting. These lists are always a bit random. I think the main sort of theme emerges is that everyone's trying to show off a little bit. And Labour MPs and Conservative MPs are showing off in slightly different ways. Labour MPs are trying to sort of read books that are sort of, they're showing off by reading books that are a bit trendy. And Conservative MPs are trying to show off by reading books that are very old and very long. is my take on this. I think the most intriguing reading recommendation is Boris Johnson, who says he's reading Evelyn Waugh's novel Scoop on holiday, which of course is about an incompetent journalist who stumbles into the wrong job, which presumably is not the analogy he was thinking of.
You know what? I bet it is. I bet he just thinks it's just funny.
Yeah. He probably does think it's just funny, but I just sort of, Scoop obviously is the absolute ultimate journalist book that every journalist will, you know, bore on and on and on about. It kind of shows that if he genuinely is reading Scoop, and maybe just picked it up at random, that shows probably that he's a bit of he's, you know, still a journalist at heart.
Have you've seen the list as well, haven't you, India? What leapt out to you?
It's really fascinating, this list, actually. I think you can tell a lot about people by what they claim they're going to read as well as what they do read. I don't believe that half the people on this list are going to read the books that they claim they're going to read. Lots of things leapt out. One of them being Rishi Sunak claiming that he's going to spend summer reading a book called 12 Yards by Ben Littleton, which is about football. It's about the history of the dropkick. And this seems improbable to me. It's like Rishi Sunak saying he's going to read, I don't know, Hold My Pint, A History of Beer. You know, it's kind of man of the people kind of choice. It's supposed to indicate and signify and hint at all sorts of kind of ordinary life going on, and I don't believe him.
Yeah, it's the art and psychology of the perfect penalty.
I mean, come on. Come on.
That's been, that does feel like one that may have been sort of photo focus grouped.
Yes,
quite heavily before getting onto that. I was quite struck that of all the people, and loads, you know, cabinet ministers and shadow cabinet ministers, and all that, but we don't know what Keir Starmer's going to be reading. He doesn't seem to have responded to this request. I don't know.
I was trying to imagine, re your previous item. I was trying to imagine Keir Starmer playing a game, and I couldn't. I mean, maybe chess or backgammon, but like a game, a rumbustious game with lots of kind of shouting and, you know, whacking the table and or even running about outside batting things. I just can't picture it at all. And I also find it quite difficult to imagine him reading something that is fun.
Yes. Well, in fact, when we've been asking for games that MPs might be playing on the last day of term, Lindsay had suggested Keir Starmer be playing solitaire, which is a bit cruel. But also entirely plausible. What do we overall? What do we get from? What do we learn about our politicians from their summer reading list? Do you think, James?
God, I mean,
are there
so many
stinkers on there. Books that you think are dreadful that nobody should be reading.
But I really can't believe that Robert Halfen MP is reading The Silmarillion by J.R.R. Tolkien, which is a deeply boring, deeply nerdy book, beloved only of teenage boys around the age of 15, and even they don't finish it.
Exactly.
I'm very sceptical that William Ragg is reading The Way We Live Now by Anthony Trollope, which is completely enormous and is, you know, the Bible of anyone who is trying to show off what a great love they have of Victorian novels that nobody reads. I just think it's so random, it's hard to draw any conclusions. I think you can split into people who, as I said, are being pretentious by reading old books, pretentious by reading new books, and then the handful of people who are reading books that, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people put Delia Owens' Where the Crawdads Sing, a couple of them, and I believe that they're reading this book, which is a bit of a phenomenon in the last couple of years, a kind of middle brown novel that a lot of people are actually, you know, are reading. I believe them, but I think there's a lot of, I mean, I think we can't even get, you know, I can't even begin to get into the kind of psychological games and things that people are trying to play with the books they've recommended. Grant Shapps is reading The Years of Lyndon Johnson by Robert Caro, which is a book that, if you get a list like this of politicians recommending books, inevitably one politician will recommend this to show how au fait they are with what is, you know, famously the ultimate political biography and, you know, the Bible of how to do politics. It is actually a brilliant book. So I'm always glad to see that comes up. I mean, the whole thing is like, I think it's so far, it's three or four volumes now, and they're all sort of, you know, between 300 and 500 pages long. So whether you're going to read the entire thing over summer, I'm a bit sceptical, but it's good to see that there, because it is an excellent book. And it is good that politicians always like to show off about having read it, because it means that people remember it exists.
What my favourite bit on the list is, there's a couple of recommendations, but which are anonymous.
Yes, why?
So somebody's recommended Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo.
They won't say who they
are. Perfectly fine.
Anonymous.
Yeah,
there's
somebody else has recommended Penny Mordaunt's book, Greater Britain After the Storm. It's like, well, maybe it's Penny Mordaunt.
And also, why has Carolyn Harris chosen a children's book? Artemis Fowl.
Yes, well, there's a bit of that, because Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, has recommended Fantastically Great Women Who Worked Wonders by Kate Pankhurst, which is a children's book about, which is, you know, it's a nice thing, you know, for your young girls and boys to read about women that have achieved a lot of NASA scientists and all. But you can't honestly think the Shadow Chancellor's summer reading is a children's book. Or at least you'd possibly hope not. So, James, with your old, now old, Deputy Books Editor hat on, what would you recommend for MPs to be reading this summer?
Oh my God, that's so. I having banged on about Robert Caro, I do think everybody should read that because it would make a lot of, I think it would make a lot of people a lot more competent. When you read it, you're just like, oh my God, this is how this is how, if you are deeply skilled in the art of politics, this is how you do it. And this is someone who is, yes, probably this is about President Lyndon Johnson. Yes, someone is probably slightly a psychopath, but is also a complete genius. And in fact, you begin to wonder, do we want everybody to learn all of Lyndon Johnson's tricks? And makes you wonder whether you wouldn't prefer to have some of our politicians remaining a little more incompetent rather than having this kind of slightly terrifying insight into...
The thing that's put me off is it's so massive and there's several volumes.
It's so much of it.
So fun, though. When you get into it, I was like...
And do you know what the other thing is?
It's like a thriller. I was
present company accepted. The sort of politicians and journalists who always go on about it are quite annoying.
I agree.
That slightly puts me off.
I accept I may be slightly annoying.
No, present company accepted.
I'm willing to accept that. I do think it is, like... I think it has a... Maybe now has a slightly bad reputation, but is a lot more fun than you'd think.
What about you, India? What would you recommend for politicians to read?
I've just noticed, actually, Robert Buckland, Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State for Justice, is reading the second volume of, no, the first volume, sorry, of Chips Channon's very, very un-PC, gossipy, sort of terrible but fascinating diaries, which is quite interesting because you wouldn't think he was a particularly sort of gossipy and terrible person. My recommendation for summer reading, actually, I've got a piece on this coming out, I think, either this Sunday or the Sunday after, for kind of books that feel like you're on holiday but that aren't sort of completely inane. So people will have to wait.
Good teasing ahead.
Insight.
Get yourself a Times digital subscription and all of that. I'm quite looking forward to this. So the thing that I'm genuinely going to be reading on my holiday next week is John Stonehouse, My Father, which is a book by Julia Stonehouse. And her dad was the MP who faked his own death and disappeared.
Oh, yes, then came
back. And I think the book is out this week or next week. I think she's on the show in a couple of weeks' time. And actually, I mean, obviously, I read all of the books that we discuss when people come on the show, but I'm actually really looking forward to it because I was only dimly aware of the story of John Stonehouse until I saw This House, the James Graham play about the whipping in the 70s. And John Stonehouse is like a very small part of that, where he faked his death in Miami and then turned up in Australia and was only caught because it was around the same time that Lord Lucan had gone missing, and he was a British man reading the British news in the newspaper, and someone said, "I think that's Lord Lucan." And so he was arrested by the police, and it turned out he wasn't Lord Lucan, but he had to prove he wasn't Lord Lucan. He had to reveal he was, in fact, the also not dead John Stonehouse. So anyway,
that sounds good.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to that. Yes, Julia Stonehouse, I think. What are you actually going to be reading this summer, India?
I am going to be doing what I was supposed to be doing last summer, which was rereading Simenon, many novels. You could sort of go on into until Christmas, probably. But they're very pleasing to me. They're short. They're really, really satisfying, and they are brilliant. And I'm finishing my own book, so I can only read very specific things. Otherwise, you kind of absorb other people's writing style or mannerisms, and then these strange sentences come out that aren't actually you at all. So I reckon by reading Belgian crime fiction from the 20th century, I'm probably fine.
You could steer clear of that. Talking of short and satisfying, what are you reading, James?
Well, in my life, which is now basically a perpetual hunt for column ideas, I'm going to read. I've just ordered, actually, a book I'm quite excited about. George Packer, who writes The Atlantic and The New Yorker, has got a book called The Four Americas, where he basically divides America up into four. He says America's kind of broken into these four parts. He says, I think it's just America, real America, smart America, and free America. And I want to read it and see if there's a column in which I can then divide Britain up into four Britons, but I don't know if that's going to be possible. That's my ambitious plan. I'm going to the Lake District this weekend, and that's my ambitious plan for the Lake District, which will make me very fun to be around.
Oh, I can think of worse things to go on holiday with. James, let's talk about your column about, it's sort of all, well, sorry, because it was connected, language and sort of politically correct language and the way it all just becomes sort of meaningless, euphemistic nonsense.
Yeah, well, you've put it very well. So this column basically started with another book, which I read last year and really recommend. It's really opened my mind a lot of things, which is called In Pursuit of Civility by a historian called Keith Thomas, which is a history of the birth of, basically the birth of good manners. And it's completely, to see how this stuff all kind of came about, 300, 400 years ago, completely opens your eyes to the way that we sort of interact with each other and the forms of good manners we have now. And I was sort of thinking about politically correct language, which, I think began to sort of enter our society in the 90s and, I think is now really kind of entrenched. We take so much politically correct language for granted. And reading this book by Keith Thomas, which is all about how these kind of codes of manners depend on these like very elaborate ways of speaking, always sort of trying to find a long way to say something as a sort of sign of courtesy to other people. And I was just thinking sort of so much of this is true of politically correct language. I was reading the other day, just in passing, a news story about someone who described themselves as a fat-bodied person. And I was just like, what a fascinating The phrase includes the word fat, but how fascinating that it's more polite to just say it in a more long way. So the sort of basic argument of my column, sorry, I'm being a bit roundabout here, is that I think it's kind of basically agreed that in the 60s, we kind of rejected a lot of the kind of, you know, stuffy rules about language and manners and codes of civility that, you know, we'd had for most of our history. People in the kind of 1930s consulting these etiquette books about how to write to bishops and stuff. And I think my basic theory is all that has come back, and that's probably a mark of, after that kind of economic boom from between the 60s and the 90s, this is a mark of a society that's more anxious about status, and mastering these kind of complex language codes about political correctness is often a sign for middle-class people, perhaps, to signal that they're part of this, they have this kind of cultural capital that other people don't have. That was quite a long-winded way of saying it, but basically recited my column there.
What do you think? Do you agree with James, India?
I'm really interested in the idea that inclusive language is exclusive. I think that's really fascinating, and I think it's really true. Taking the knee, for example, if you said kneeling with its connotations of respect and humility is the thing that everybody can understand. I think there wouldn't have been this difficulty, and this is sort of absurd in my mind, but anyway, there's difficulty in some people's minds about what it represented and what it signified. So I think simple language that everybody can understand makes everybody get the point of the idea much, much faster than these sort of contortions and convolutions that are really off-putting. And as James says in his column, indicates that, over here, we are right-thinking people, and all you over there who are baffled by this language or don't understand it or find it absurd are less morally good than us in the middle. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's genuinely really interesting. I think that it happens in all walks of life, in politics especially, where in an attempt to be more inclusive, you reach a point where nobody has any clue what you're talking about.
Yeah, you stop making sense.
Well, luckily, both of you make lots of sense today. India Knight and James Marriott there, and of course you can read them both in the Times and the Sunday Times. Just get yourself a subscription, go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is Harry Enfield.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now it's time for my interview with Harry Enfield. Harry Enfield began his career doing voices on spitting image of now long forgotten politicians. In the past 40 years, he's created some of the best, most enduring, memorable and funny comic characters. Thatcherite wide boys he poked fun at with loads of money, and layabouts with Wayne and Wayne Netta Slob. He sent up teenage politicians with Tory Boy, and just about every teenager everywhere with Kevin the Teenager. Well, moving from politics to royalty, he's been playing Prince Charles in the brilliant Channel 4 series The Windsors, which is a sort of deranged soap opera taking us behind the velvet curtains of the royal family. And now he's taking it onto the stage. One of the biggest new shows to open on the West End this summer, fingers crossed, The Windsors Endgame. We'll see Harry making his musical's debut. Well, I caught up with Harry this week between rehearsals. Keep an eye, ear out, enjoy this, for song and dance numbers in the background. And I asked about everything from how to get a break in comedy to that Question Time sketch. just so that, you know, there is a teeny tiny bit of adult language, but nothing to make you choke on your 11s. It seemed gratuitous to beep it out. So this is my interview with Harry Enfield, and I began by asking him to explain the Windsors to the uninitiated.
The Windsors is what Tracy Ann Oberman, who's playing Camilla, she says that it's like The Crown, only based on fact. That's her thing, which I think is a very good line. As I see it on television, what we do is I see it as like the writers of Dynasty have been told to write a thing about the royals, but they don't know anything about the royals because they live in LA, and all they've been given are the British red tops for their research material. So it's all purely based on what's been written in the papers and then exaggerated a bit. So it's like a ridiculous soap opera, yeah.
So there are like grains of truth in there, and Harry and William have their sort of fallings out, and Harry and Meghan are in America and all. So there are bits in there. Prince Andrew is a particularly interesting character. So there are bits in there which have a grain of truth. But you're right, it's basically like a soap opera written by someone who's only ever seen Mail Online.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all, or not just the Mail Online. You know, there was something in one of the papers the other day with, you know, that. Sorry, that's just someone being tortured out there. I'll tell you about that in a minute. It's got torture, this show. You know, there was something the other day with, it was like Will's quote, you know, "I'll never speak to you again, Harry, unless you divorce Meghan." And you think, you know, who made that up? And who, you know, it's rubbish. So it's like full of that kind of stuff that I'm sure the royals, if they saw it, they just think, well, this is just ridiculous. You know, not based on them at all.
I was going to ask you that, because obviously at various times, stars of The Crown have mentioned it, you know, maybe William's seen an episode or Camilla. Have you ever been aware of anyone in and around the royals having seen the Windsors?
Well, you hear sort of rumours about it, Matt, but, you know, you can't back them up. The kind of rumours that would make the red tops, but make my voice.
And what about, so you play Prince Charles?
I play Prince Charles in the on telly, and in the end game, yeah, I play Prince Charles. And the basic plot is that the Queen has now abdicated, and it's like a battle to the death between Wills and Kate and Charles and Camilla. And Charles and Camilla are trying to take Britain back to the Dark Ages, because Boris Johnson was pissed when he did the Brexit treaty. And instead of putting... putting power back to 1973, he put it back to 1173. So I'm technically the feudal lord of all of Britain. And Wills and Kate are sort of there to try and restore constitutional monarchy. And it's got lots of torture, as you just heard.
So that's what's going on in the background, because you're in the middle of rehearsals right now.
Yeah, sorry, there's a song going on about the Fab Four.
So it's an all-singing, all-dancing West End production.
Yeah, this is a big... Yeah, it's the first time I've done musical theatre, darling. And I now feel like a proper actor.
I've seen your live show that you did with Paul Whitehouse. There's a certain amount of moving around at the same time as music. But
yeah, a little bit of shuffling around. Yeah, we did.
This is proper musical.
Yeah, this is proper music. Well, it's got five really good songs in it, so it's like half a musical. Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, they're so brilliant. Everybody, you know, it's like the only people from the telecast, me and Matt, who plays Edward, and Tim, who plays Andrew. And obviously Andrew's got a fairly big role, but and Matt is sort of... Prince Edward is the sort of master of ceremonies kind of thing, and everyone else... is new for the musical kind of thing, and they've all got amazing voices, and they're really funny. It's just really good.
So I know you're an opera fan. Are you an opera quality singer?
No, I am not. But I do have a deep bass voice. He got rather like the musical director said, "Oh, you've got a very deep voice." Yes, I have. So
I normally get told
very into it now.
In that situation, I normally get told I've got a very deep voice and can I stop singing? Because that's the only thing you can hear.
Well, I do at home, yeah. I get told to stop singing, yeah.
You're playing Prince Charles on stage. You've obviously done impressions. You know, you were doing Spitting Image. Did you used to do Charles when you were doing Spitting Image?
No, Chris Barry did.
Okay.
No, I didn't do Charles. I mean, no one would know any of these people anymore. You know, it's people like... I don't know, Leon Britton, people like that. I did.
Yeah, so that's who you would do. But you've had your career's been punctuated with like your own creations, but then also satirical send-ups of
yeah. And I've actually I played the Queen a couple of years ago for David Walliams. Yeah, it's a very funny sketch actually. It's called "Who Does One Think One Is?" I played the Queen, and we put David on some boxes so that I'm tiny, and it works really well. It's great. It looks really sweet.
And their grandson was your grandfather, King George V.
Now, what did he do?
He was the king.
Another one. You're having a laugh. One's in danger of getting rather big-headed. One's family tree seems to be chock-a-block with kings and queens.
Yes.
When I was looking back through everything you've done and all the stuff of yours that I've always enjoyed, there is a thread of politics that runs through it, whether it was loads of money, was satirising that sort of Thatcherite mentality.
I've got piles! Piles and money! Loads of money!
In fact, on Loads of Money, when you were doing it, at what point do you, I've had this similar conversation with Al Murray when he was talking about the pub landlord. When the person you're sending up starts enjoying the thing that you're doing.
Well, I think everyone enjoys being sent up. You know, that's always been the case. You know,
yeah.
That's what your mates do. They take the piss out of you, don't they? And that's what your family do. Yeah. So, of course, they enjoyed it. You know, there was a sort of thing, I think, in The Guardian at the time of, oh, Harry's given up doing the character because the people who he was sending up like it. And I thought, well, that's because it's funny that they like it and because I'm taking the piss out of them.
Yeah.
You know, I've got these characters like the one who has a shop called I Saw You Coming, which yes. are really popular with people who go to shops called I Saw You Coming, you know, because, you know, that's what a sense of humour is, taking the piss out of yourself.
Yeah, and that self-recognition, you go, oh, God, I am that person. And what about Tory Boy?
Do you want to look out of your bedroom window one morning to find that your car has been taken away by a stranger? It's not been stolen. Oh, no. It's been given away by Brussels to a Spanish fisherman. That's what Tony Blair wants.
Who was that based on? William Hague is probably the most obvious one, but yeah. Who else was in that melting pot?
I don't really know. It was sort of William Hague, really.
Yeah.
Who, you know, when I was growing up and into punk and reggae and stuff, he was appearing at the Tory party conference, you know. And so he was always a sort of a bit of a bête noire, really, in terms of, you know, as a kid. I've met him since, and he's really, really funny and clever. And in fact, I did a gig with him once, and he made a speech and he brought the house down, and I made a speech and no one laughed at all. So hats off to him. He got his revenge.
Well, he's now a very valued, he's now a Times columnist. He's now a stablemate.
Is he a lord or something now?
Yes, he is a lord now. Right. He's a lord and he writes for the Times. So, you know, he's a fine guy. I'm glad you were so... You're
a very good writer and he's a very, very funny man. Get him on the subject of John Redwood.
Well, that was Harry Enfield. And we'll hear more from him in a moment. But as I mentioned to him there, William Hague is a Times columnist and he appears on the Leaders Panel on Times Radio every Tuesday. So this week, because I spoke to Harry early this week, we put what Harry Enfield had to say to William Hague. Stig and Asma asked him if he remembers the night that William Hague brought the house down.
I have to say, I don't really. I've given so many speeches, after dinner speeches, must be thousands of them over the years. I vaguely remember some occasion where Harry Enfield did really bomb. And by the way, he's saying all those nice things about me. Harry Enfield, he's great company. He is, you know, he's at least as funny as he looks. He was a little bit unsure there in that clip as to who Tory Boy was based on. And it didn't sound like me or look like me. So if it was based on me, it was pretty loosely based.
There's William Hague responding to those allegations. Now, I can't speak to you and not ask you about the Question Time sketch, which I think is one of the greatest 3 minutes of TV comedy ever.
Oh, no, that's very kind of you, Matt.
I think partly because I've had to sit through Question Time so often.
Yeah.
And you've taken my entire life experience of watching it and distilled it into 3 minutes.
It was good fun to do at the time, you know.
Did you have to spend a lot of time watching
Harry
it?
And Paul. I think that
was on Harry and Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it is on YouTube. If everyone feeling
yeah,
a
no,
bit,
it's really good fun. But it's moved on from there because it's not David Dimbleby anymore, no. And it, you know, the issues are different. You know, now it would all be the COVID, wouldn't it? Does the panel think the COVID, and has the government got it completely wrong and all that stuff? You know, wouldn't it?
But it still just works because you have all the same, exactly the same issues raised by the same. So it is terrific. Do you, it's interesting you're doing royals and not politics. Would you do anything political?
Well, there is sort of politics in the Windsors. You know, I remember there was a brilliant, a row I was having with Wills in one of the things. And it was one of the programmes. And, you know, and Wills is saying, don't you think we're irrelevant now? And I'm going, well, someone's paying me £19 million a year to do something. And it was like, oh, help. Really? Is that what he gets paid? You know, it's sort of fairly hard, you know. And I think that's what Bert and George, the writers, have always thought. You know, they're fair game because we pay for them. And, you know, they don't have to do it. And as Harry doesn't want to do it anymore, you know. But,
well, he always sort of does, but on his own terms a bit.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, let's face it, Matt, we wouldn't swap places with any of them, would we?
No.
For the houses and this and that, you know. And this does, I guess it touches on that because there's some great scenes with Harry and Meghan over there. And then they come to rescue us and make the world all right again after the Dark Ages. And we got sword fights and everything. I get killed in the end. Oh, no.
Don't give it away.
Well, maybe it's not the end. Maybe it's just a twist.
And what I wonder if you, what was your view of the royal family before you started doing this? And do you feel more affection, sympathy towards them? Have you become a Republican as a result? Has it changed?
No, I've never really had much of a feeling about the royal family other than respect. And, you know, I do respect them and I wouldn't want to be them. And I'm not a royalist, but, you know, I'd sooner, I don't know who I'd prefer, Gary Lineker, maybe.
As an elected head
maybe
of state.
Maybe a showbiz elected head of state. Someone who's never been in politics as head of state is a good thing to have. But let's face it, you know, there's very few things that Prince Charles says in life that I disagree with. You know, he's been banging on about the environment for the last 30, 40 years. And, you know, people find out a bit too much about his private life and they mock him for that. And we all mock him for that. And he has to put up with that. But I wouldn't mind him being absolute monarch for 10 years.
If only to sort out climate change. If he just...
Yeah.
Just
I'm not, you know, I'm not a royalist, but I think as a man, you know, he's a good man.
I mean, part of me was thinking in normal times, you'd have the tourists flocking, expecting a sort of tribute to the royal family and then coming away thinking, that can't be right.
Yeah. Is that right? Do they really do that? Yeah, that would be good. Especially there's a sex scene. I'm having sex with Camilla in one bit. They wouldn't like that, the tourists, would they?
I suspect not. So how is it in putting up a show in the middle of or the tail end of a pandemic and other shows being knocked out. How much have you been tested
Yeah, we test ourselves every day. We do all that, you know. I mean, obviously, I'm ancient now. I'm the oldest person by miles. I'm 60 now. And I'm a decade older than anyone else, at least. And so I'm the grand old man, darling. Well, I'm the junior. I'm the new boy at musical theatre. And... you know, I've had my jabs, everyone's had their jabs, and, you know, we're just getting on with it and kind of positive energy, and the tickets are selling. And if you get 60,000 people at a football match, I think we're going to be fine. I think we're going to be fine. And if people are worried about it, they should just test themselves before they come or whatever. But I think we're all going to be fine.
And just fingers crossed that none of you test positive, because that seems to be what's knocking out other shows.
I don't think we will.
And then what have you, how long, because it's quite, it's a sort of limited run, isn't it? How long is it on for if people are, do you want to get tickets?
Yeah, it's on for the 2nd of August, the previews start. Then we open on the 10th and it closes after the first week of October.
It's the Prince of Wales Theatre, isn't it?
Prince of Wales Theatre, named after me.
entirely fittingly. And then what, I mean, without giving too much away about what happens at the end of the play, is that the end of the Windsors then?
Well, I think we hope that we'll get this in such good shape. It'll be in such good shape by the end that, you know, when we're in more normal times, we can do it again. That's certainly my thought, is it'd be great to take it around the country. You know, it's a bit like a panto. There's a bit of booing and shouting and stuff. And I walk amongst the audience trying to sell people sweets and stuff. And, you know, it's like really good fun. And I hope that we'll just carry on doing it. I don't know about the end of the Windsors. George, who wrote the Windsors with Bert, sadly died last year. And so Bert's sort of on his own now. But we, you know, I'd love them to do it again on Channel 4, but I know they haven't got any money.
And I suppose, yeah, doing it live in front of an audience at least means that's more your natural territory, isn't it? Being able to hear that people are enjoying what the thing that you're doing.
It's just such fun to do. You know, I've done a couple of other plays, but this has been such fun. And I just know everyone's going to love it who comes.
And just finally, I want to ask you, because you mentioned you were 60. I wasn't going to do that, but you've been in the business for some time now. Having gone from being part-time milkman and mate of the plaster Paul Whitehouse to, you know, being on the TV almost overnight. Yeah. How tough is it these days for comedians to get a similar break? Like you were saying, you know, TV channels don't want to spend money on comedy these days.
Well, I think sketch comedy is hard because for some reason the budgets go down and down and down. I mean, they've always been much lower than drama, but they go down and down and down. And in the end, you know, with Harry and Paul, when we were doing that, we just couldn't make it anymore because it's much more expensive to make in terms of, you know, if you're changing character all day, you're in makeup half the day, so you only get half the day filming. And so, you know, it just became, you know, I mean, budget-wise, it became hard. But I'm hoping to do a thing for the BBC next year because it's 100 years of the BBC. And I've been asked to do a kind of tribute of that because I did a sort of 50 years of BBC Two.
Yes, I remember that. And that was not some of those like parody sketches were born out of.
Yeah, so we're hoping to do a sort of 100 years thing.
So who have you got in your sights now for 100 years? You've literally got anyone for the past 100 years.
Yeah, we'll have to choose and we'll have to sort of mix and match and kind of make it all work in some sort of weird logic, you know. But I've got an idea. I think it'll work, you know. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, but for young comics, you know, I think actually it's really good. You know, they've got all these quiz shows and things like that they can go on, and that gives them publicity, and then they can go off around the country. It's harder for sketch comedy and people like me, I think. But for them, you know, for stand-up, it's never been so good, except for the pandemic, obviously.
Which, fingers crossed, we're now, you know, theatres are now open and full, and with the exception, I suppose, at least you're a stand-up.
You just have to be positive about it and, you know, hope that everything will be all right. I think we're all careful. You know, everywhere I go at the moment, people are still wearing masks. And, you know, nobody really trusts the government to, if they say, oh, yeah, you don't have to wear a mask now, that might be the law. But they've done so many U-turns, as they did at the weekend. You know, I don't think anyone really trusts that. So we're all sort of carrying on at the moment.
Yeah, the wisdom of crowds. People look about and think, well, everyone else has got a mask and I'll stick mine on. And if it means that they get to go out, go on the train, go on the tube, go to the theatre, then that's, you know, a mask seems like a small price to pay. But
I think it's going to be fun.
Yes, exactly. We could do with some fun. And I'm not sure there's more fun or any silliness, anything quite so silly as the Windsor's Endgame. So it sounds
especially when Meghan gets tortured. As you just heard.
Live torturing on Zoom. Harry Enfield.
Got a wonderful scream. Wonderful.
That was what clinched it for in the audition. Harry Enfield, it's been lovely to speak to you. Best of luck with the Windsor's Endgame when it will definitely open on August the 2nd.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Matt.
That's Harry Enfield there. And you can find out more about the show and get tickets to the Windsor's Endgame.com. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.